I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. 3 years ago next month, the noted writer Carolyn Adderson began a Facebook page, Vancouver Vanishes. It came about because she noticed on her morning walks the Kerrisdale neighborhood in Vancouver's west side, where she lives, was changing dramatically. Houses like hers, built before the 1940s, were being demolished at a fast pace. The page would feature photographs she shot of character homes, well-made and lived in, and would somehow call attention, or yell stop at least, to the rapid development going on, not only on the west side, but throughout Vancouver. Where I live in the Kensington Cedar Cottage neighborhood, we're seeing redevelopment, but thankfully it's nothing like that which is happening out west, especially in Canby Street, where houses from King Edward south to 41st and westward are being boarded up, with that colored plastic fencing being erected around the property signaling demolition. Carolyn Adderson joins me now to talk about the remarkable new book, aptly titled Vancouver Vanishes, Narratives of Demolition and Revival. She has a number of essays in the book that features her photographs, as well as those of Tracy Eiton, and pieces from John Atkin, Kerry Gold, Evelyn Lau, Eve Lazarus, John Mackey, Elise and Stephen Partridge, and Bren Summers. Michael Kluckner writes the book's introduction, which is published by Anvil Press. Carolyn Adderson is the acclaimed novelist and short story writer of books that have received 3 BC Book Prizes and a number of CBC Literary Awards. She has been nominated for the major book prizes in this country and beyond. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Carolyn Adderson. Ms. Adderson, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for your interest in this subject.
So I'm 33 and have lived in Vancouver my whole life, and even at 33 I can get pretty nostalgic about where I live and what's around me. Kerry Gold in the book says something that I've been keenly aware of in recent years. Everything about Vancouver these days feels rushed, as if we have to get a move on. Well, which means that you know, houses are getting torn down and in great numbers, and we're not realizing what we're losing. And in a way, I guess this book is a way of pointing out what's happening.
Yes, that's the purpose. I was trying to get, you know, the subject is in the media quite a bit, but it doesn't really get into the real value of these old houses. And I just wanted something a bit more reflective, a bit literary, and I wanted to gather together some of the photographs that I've taken. When you look at them on the Facebook page, you see one at a time, but when you gather them all together and you see all of them with the word demolished, 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 it really kind of hits home the extent of our loss.
Yeah, it is heartbreaking, not just only in the loss of, say, these houses which look nice off the street, because granted, a lot of people who live here probably haven't been in some of these houses, especially in your neighborhood, if you live where I do. But the stories, mm-hmm. the people that have been lost along the way. And
mm-hmm.
and I mean, the stories in the book, like John Atkin's neighbors, for example, Tankman and Ray Filmon. I mean, your own neighbor, Pearl King.
Mm-hmm.
If they hadn't been mentioned in this book, they would have been gone just like their homes.
Yes, well, why I was actually drawn to this subject, because I'm a fiction writer, so my whole day is spent working with narrative. And when I started this, I had to figure out, why does this bother me so much? I mean, it is certainly the environmental waste and the hypocrisy of, you know, crowing on and on about being a green city and then smashing up perfectly good, renovated, beautiful homes, clear-cutting the lot, putting a synthetic, much larger plastic house with 11-foot ceilings and 7 bathrooms. I mean, that offends me, but, you know, I'm not a member of any environmental group. So I really had to look inside myself and say, what is it about you that's really, really bothering you so much that you're in devoting many hours a week to this project? I mean, I had no idea 3 years later I would still be doing this and that I would eventually publish a book about it. But then I gradually figured it out, and it was that these old houses are to me repositories of narrative. And this comes in 2 ways. The first is what I would call the embedded story of the house. So these houses are built with old growth wood. So old growth wood is hand logged. So you have this intense human interaction with harvesting of the wood that goes into the houses, and then these houses are constructed by hand. I mean, they didn't have power tools. They didn't have anything prefab or Rona. Every house, even the little modest ones, is unique. So you have this embedded in the house, the story of the wood, where it came from, where it was harvested, and then you have the story of the people who built it. So well crafted these houses are. And then you have the stories that I call the absorbed story. So these are the lives of everybody who ever lived in the house. The house, through time, comes to stand for all those people. And that's another problem with our new builds, is that it takes time for this to happen. I mean, we don't look at a new house and think, oh, there's a bunch of stories in that house, because it's new. So how long does it take before the house absorbs the stories? So I've also given a lot of thought to this. And this is my own theory. It's not scientific. But I have noticed that when I first moved to Vancouver in 1986, the housing form, the Vancouver Special, was maligned. I mean, everybody thought they were hideous and ugly and
boring.
But recently there's been this great swelling of love for them, so much that the Vancouver Heritage Foundation has a Vancouver Special tour now.
Uh-huh.
And partly that's because these are very adaptable houses, but also I think it's because they are now 50 years old. And so that's kind of the point where we start to look at a building form and say, wow, it's holding the stories. And those stories are so important because those houses were largely built by new immigrants, and those are stories we want to hear now. So when we take these all down, it's not just this grotesque environmental waste. It's not just a loss of affordability because, you know, these houses aren't affordable anymore anyway, but you could, you know, densify the lot a bit better with retaining the original house and allow people who live in Vancouver and work here to maintain these houses. So it's not only a loss of affordability, a loss of green space, an environmental loss, a loss of density too, because of course they're twice as big with three car garages and nobody lives in them.
Yeah.
So it's also this loss of stories, and those stories are what gives the city its layers, you know, and we're just throwing that into the chipper.
So the question then for someone listening, especially if they're from out of town, is why? And I guess there are two aspects here that we can touch on, and we can talk about why that's happening politically in terms of the laws and bylaws in this part of the world and the government that's at Cambie and 12th at City Hall. But just the demand for taking these houses down and replacing them. I mean, where does that come from? That's, I guess, new money or money that's coming into the city from elsewhere.
Yes, largely. Everything is now a building lot. So, you know, in the past, it would be the run-down little houses that would go, and
yeah,
people would say, well, that makes sense, you know, they're old and they should go. I mean, I personally don't feel that way, just because when I see one of these little run-down houses, usually they were lived in by an elder, and they're only run down because they didn't have the finances to keep them up. They're perfectly renewable, these houses, and they're also the way an average person would enter the housing market. That's why I happened to live here, was we bought one such house, you know, this is a very important way to enter the housing market.
Yeah.
Nowadays, however, everything is a building lot. Everything, if the zoning permits a larger house on the lot, it is purchased as a building lot regardless of the house. The house is irrelevant. So we are seeing the most beautiful, immaculately updated, maintained, beautiful homes going down simply because the zoning permits a new house. And, of course, these cost $4 to $6 million now, and I think the average income in Vancouver is something like $75,000. So obviously, these are not being built for the local market.
Yeah, and so one will wonder just how our demographics are changing, but at the same time, a lot of people who have bought houses and taken them down and rebuilt them choose not to live here, which is something that Michael Kluckner touches on. In his introduction to your book,
mm-hmm.
and that says something to people who, like yourself, have lived here a long time, or myself, who have lived here my whole life.
Why does somebody who has no investment in the community have the right to totally alter the community?
Yeah. And so do you think these questions are being considered in the city as much as they ought to be?
In City Hall or amongst the populace?
Amongst the populace, I'm sure. Like, I mean, you and I are talking about it today.
Yeah.
But I guess then it goes into to why City Hall isn't.
Well, I think they are. And certainly what I've learned over the last 3 years of doing this and finding myself speaking at council and writing many, many, many letters, you know, I didn't have much knowledge beforehand about how city government actually works. They have a number of plans that they are putting forward, and one of them is a Heritage Action Plan. There was a recent significant triumph there in that they they passed the bylaw to create our first heritage conservation area. Now, there's 70 of these in BC, but we had none in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. There were 10 in Victoria. So the fact that they pushed that through despite a lot of very vocal opposition by the demolition forces in that historic neighborhood, that was passed. So the significance of it is that it has citywide applicability. So conceivably, we could now see more heritage conservation areas in other parts of the city now that this precedent has been set. So that's great. They are trying to do other things, like regarding the green demolition program. There's your oxymoron for you.
Yeah.
And they actually started that program to try to deter character home demolitions, but I mean, I'm going to council on Wednesday there to address the new update that they just put out, and it says right there it's done nothing to deter character home demolitions. I mean, it's great that this stuff isn't going to the landfill, but it's still going to the chipper, you know, like hardly any better. They have a new tree policy, so they're doing these things kind of piecemeal, and as an outsider, my observation is they really have to get everybody together, like all the departments that touch on this issue, and give them the directive that these original houses are the most sustainable, and they are a key point in affordability and density, and all the city goals can radiate out of preserving these homes. So I think that they're moving toward that. And let me just say that this is a problem many parts of the world, and particularly along the west coast of Canada and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And if they could solve this, wow. Like, this would be some city, you know. It would be really, really impressive. So I'm not without hope. I mean, I was without hope this time last year. This year I'm feeling a lot better.
Yeah, but you know, it's still, you look at the back of the book and you see these photographs of all these houses that are gone.
Yeah,
we can't bring that back, and in a small way your book does. But there's one character in the book that I particularly liked, and I like the photograph that's there of her, and that's Pearl King, who was your neighbor for a number of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we moved into our house in 1999, and Pearl King was in her early 90s then. She died when she was 96, and she had lived in her house, which was four doors down from me, since she was 10 years old. So when I began trying to discover the stories of my own house, who had lived here, I realized, I should go down and talk to Pearl. So I went down and knocked on her door, and, you know, of course she knew everything and knew everybody, and put me in touch with the first, it was actually the second owner. There was someone, a retired barber, lived in our house for a year, and then he sold it to the Scott family. And so Madeline Scott, who was 6 months old when she moved into our house, she came from Saskatchewan by train in a dresser drawer. And I contacted her, and she came over, and I heard, you know, the whole story filled out. And Pearl was just such a treat to have on the street, and it was so wonderful to have someone around who knew the history. The four first houses on our street were built by the same builder. Uh-huh. Ours is the only one left. And I took my Pearl to Carisdale School, which is one of the few heritage schools that was saved instead of demolished. They had a 100th anniversary, and I took Pearl there. My son came here when he was sick, moved into this house when he was 6 months old. There's all these connections between the past and the present, you know, and that's how you create those layers. And if you tear out the past, you tear it out, you're always starting over. There's no depth.
Yeah. So you moved into your house, you said, in 1999.
Yes.
The block on both sides looked like, it had houses like yours.
It had a lot more.
Yeah.
So that's for sure.
So what does it look like today?
Well, so Pearl's house was demolished.
Uh-huh.
She died, and she was a single woman. I guess she would have called herself a spinster.
Uh-huh.
And her family, she bequeathed the house to some American relatives who sold it immediately. Luckily, I went and got a lot of features out of her house, which was original.
Yeah.
My house, when I moved into it, had been, you know, the 60s and 70s were fairly influential in the updates in my house. So I managed, thanks to Pearl, to restore some of the original features in the sister house.
Yeah.
And I've forgotten your question.
Yeah.
Oh, what the street looked like.
Yeah. So
there were quite a number of 1990s builds that came in this first demolition wave, and so that's really an interesting point too, because across the street there's an original house, and two doors down from that one is a brand new build. So that build replaced a very ugly, mold-colored 1990s house. And, of course, I'm not sad to see that gone. So I watched them build this present house.
Yeah.
So this is now the third house on that lot. And they built that in about 4 weeks. And these houses are made out of plywood. You know, the standard of build is approximately 30 years for wooden houses that they're building now. And so, you know, I bet you before I'm carried out of my house in a box, there'll be a fourth house there. So, you know, all this grotesque waste, we have to keep realizing that it, you know, they don't build the same way. They don't build for the ages like they used to. And these older houses can carry on. There are houses from the 1700s in Eastern Canada, Eastern United States, built of wood, and there are 800-year-old wooden houses in the other places in the world, so they can carry on, and these ones will just keep being knocked down and replaced. It's really heartbreaking is the word.
Yeah.
Anyway, we still have a number on this street, but we've lost Pearl's Went, the people who lived next to Pearl and were essentially looking after her before she died. You know, they were an older couple, their children grown up. So they sold. Their house was torn down. The house two doors down from them was torn down. And, you know, there goes the community. You know, where before I had neighbors, the people that I would see on the street and talk to. I mean, I have a couple of neighbors who are still around, but it's pretty quiet.
Yeah. I had a chuckle in one of the pieces that you wrote in the book about I guess when you moved into your house, you had some work done, and you noticed the smell come up in the middle of the night. And someone told you that it's probably the people that built the house years ago that used to pee in the plaster, I guess?
Yes, so we had a renovation, and we had our bathroom renovated. And so to get at the pipes, because of the tiling, they had to cut a hole in the wall in the master bedroom. And if you ever go in these old houses when they're being deconstructed, there is this very beautiful hummusy kind of smell that comes off of them. So this was opened up, and I woke up in the night with this. This is really what made me go and discover who had lived in my house, because I smelled this. I really felt like I was smelling the lives that came before me.
Yeah.
And then the contractor came, and he had a big laugh when I told him this, because his father had been a or his grandfather had been a plasterer, and he said they used to pee in the mortar and just claimed it made it stronger, but it wasn't that. But anyway, it was funny.
Yeah, so it got me thinking about the people that I mean, you got thinking about the people that built these houses. It got me thinking about the people that are taking down these houses, the construction workers that are involved in demolitions. Have you talked to them and had any insight as to how they feel in their role in all of this? I mean, to a lot of them, it's just a job, so, I mean, you can't fault them, obviously. But, I mean, it must, having to take down things that look nice and that mean a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah, well, here's an example. This house came down on 25th and Blenheim, and it turned out to be a very significant house. It was by H.H. Simmons, who did the Stanley Theater. He did the Lee Block, which was demolished earlier this year, and I have a piece in the book about the Lee Block as well. This house was just totally restored and absolutely stunning house, and so I went over to take pictures, and there was a guy at the back jackhammering. He was putting in the utility pole that they use when they have to get electricity for their tools when they're building the house after the electricity is cut off. So he was there jackhammering, and I said, "Are they tearing down the house?" And he said, "No, they wouldn't do that." Then I went around the front of the house, and there was the guy putting up the orange fences, and I said, "Is the house coming down?" And he said, "Yes, what's it to you?" So anyway, I went back around and actually went in the house because it was open, and then I told the guy, "They're tearing it down." And he had such a look of shock on his face. I mean, I really notice in this issue, there are people who get it, and there are people who don't. There are people to whom a house has emotional value, and we think of them as homes. They're the settings for our lives, and we connect emotionally to these places. And there are other people who are, you know, everything is money. I'm not saying they're bad. They just have a different way of looking at the world. It's all about the economy, and this is what's driving us forward, and who cares? It's gold. It's gone. Who cares? That, you know, we just aren't thinking in the same way.
So when you had the woman that came into your house who'd lived there years ago, in the book you tell the story about your own house and who built it, who lived there, and you go right up to the people that you bought it from.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to know how you got all that information. You mentioned in the book that you looked at city directories, and so for a lot of us, we don't know what those are.
Yes, well, this will be very useful to your listeners because I get asked many times about how do you find this information, and it's actually so easy now. When I did my own house, the city directories weren't available online, and they are now up until 1955, so it's actually quite easy. So the Vancouver Public Library has all of these, what were called city directories, and they were kind of like a phone book, but they had, this is before there were phone books, and then later you'll see where they add telephone numbers, and it's really neat to see the telephone numbers because they're different than our telephone numbers. They, you know, have letters in them, and so I love that moment where you switch over to the telephone numbers. It's so, and they have ads all around them, you know, private detectives and all crazy things. It's just wonderful. So these were big books, and people would every year fill out the questionnaire saying, you know, their name and their occupation. And so you can go to the Vancouver Public Library website and go in their historical information and click on that and then click on city directories. And if you know approximately when your house was built, you can click on that year, and then it's like a microfiche, a PDF of the actual physical book, and you scroll down until you find your address, and then there'll be the name of a person, and then they also have it by name. So once you have the name of the person, then you go back and you click on name and find the person by the name, and then they'll tell you their occupation. And why I think this has made the Facebook so effective is, again, it has to do with story. So what I post is I'll post a picture of the house, and then it says address, and then year built, and then first owner, and there I have the name and occupation, and sometimes there's a spouse listed, and then status demolished. But that little bit of information, so the name is the person.
Yeah.
The house is the place. And then the occupation, you immediately picture someone doing something. So that's the thing, right? So that's all a story is, a person, a place, and a thing. Any writer starts a story, I have a person in the place, and they're doing something, or something happens,
yeah.
Right? And so that's how people connect to the picture, and is that they see the story in the house by knowing just this tiny information bit of information.
Yeah, and then you mentioned some of these companies that these people work for. A lot of them, so some of them are still around.
Yes.
A lot of them are not.
Yes.
And you get a fascinating insight into sort of the stuff that people did day-to-day to make their living.
Yes.
And the sort of jobs that are gone now.
Yes, and even sometimes the way they describe the jobs, like mm-hmm. the last posting I did, he was a golf professor, which I assume was a golf pro. I always thought it was professional, but when you look up the abbreviation P-R-O-F in the city directory is professor. So I wrote golf professor. And now I have this just totally different image of these, you know, the old guy with the in the white knickers, teaching golf at the Shaughnessy Golf Club in 1930. You know, you just see these incredible pictures just with this tiny little bit of information.
Yeah, a janitor and his housewife.
Yeah.
Could afford to live in your neighborhood.
Oh, this was a very working class neighborhood.
Yeah.
So a barber was the first owner. And the next owner, the Scott family, well, he was this kind of crazy entrepreneur. He was he started a business in egg candling. So, you know, when I wrote that piece, I didn't even know what egg candling was. And it turns out that even today, eggs are candled, but not with actual candles. They were actually using candles then. So that's, they hold the egg up to the light.
To see if they're, that, yeah.
You know, to grade the egg. And so he would deliver the eggs all around, and then he had his finger in a bunch of different businesses. He had an ice cream shop, but he was also a semi-professional magician, and that was the thing that really thrilled me, was to find out that in my basement there was all this magician's equipment, and, you know, the box with the rubber legs sticking out, and all the doves, cages of doves and rabbits, and it's so enriching to find out who lived in your house before you. And, you know, I sometimes get the sense that in a way they're still here.
So in his column on your book, Alan Garr in the Vancouver Courier mentions that a lot of these changes are because of money, people moving to the city, investing into, not even moving in the city, but just investing in property in this town. You know, a lot of people like to deflect the issue by saying it's a racial thing, and the mayor even suggests that that there's a racist tone simply bringing this up. I mean, do you think we're unwilling in this town to have, say, sensitive but altogether important discussions about how this city is changing with regards to race and
well,
that involvement?
To me, it has nothing to do with race. It has to do with who that has the money. And if we were in other parts of the world, it would be the Saudis, or it would be the Russians, or, you know, it's race is absolutely irrelevant. And I'm not saying no house should be demolished. Are you kidding? We have so many houses that are so horrible and already at the end of their lifespan. So I'm saying let's get some measures in place to protect the remaining original housing stock that we have, which is the greenest housing stock that we have, and let's steer these people who are looking just for a building lot toward another housing form. And there is a way to do this. In the parts of the city where we still have a lot of older houses, Strathcona, Grandview, etc., so that is because of the zoning. It's because if you tear the house down, you can't build a bigger house. So there is your answer right there. If they reduce the footprint of the new build to the footprint of the existing house and only allowed accessory buildings such as laneways, bigger garages, etc., if they, you know, encourage the creation of basement suites, we could get a greener, more denser living form on these older properties. And everybody who wants their big mansion can tear down one of these 1990 houses that are so shoddily built, and they can put up their fancy house there.
Yeah.
Everybody's
yeah.
happy. It
yeah.
doesn't matter what race you're from. It's irrelevant to me.
What, I mean, because the book, I mean, since the book's come out, I mean, I'm curious to know what the response you've gotten from people. A lot of people are taking to your message, obviously. Do people ask you why, say, only your neighborhood and not, say, where I live or further east or northeast?
Yeah, it's true, but they do say that. And this is a practical, I have a practical answer. You know, I'm doing this as a volunteer in my spare time. I'm a self-employed writer, so I take these pictures walking the dog in the morning. So that will give you an idea of how bad it is that I'm able to get so many pictures
yeah.
just within walking distance. But I say all the time on the Facebook page, if you live in another part of the city, please send me a picture. Send me a picture of the house. I will do all the work. You know, just send it to me. I would like it to be a cross-city record, because it's happening everywhere except in those areas where zoning discourages it.
And so you think that, I mean, you do have hope, not just with the regime at City Hall now, but say people my vintage, the younger generations, that they're keenly aware of what's going on in the city and they do care?
Oh, I think the people care very much, very much. You asked about the response that I'm getting, and you know, I occasionally get somebody who, you know, snaps at me like, you know, this private property, I have my property rights, which is also nonsense because, you know, try to put a deck on your house or something like that.
Right.
The city involves itself in every little change you would want to make to your house. You don't have free rein on your property. You know, there are people who don't care. But the majority of people who, you know, come up and talk to me or write to me or post on the Facebook page are as distraught as I am about what's going on. So, you know, people have to speak out. It's not enough to click like on a Facebook page.
Yeah.
I think that's had some influence because I send my postings, I email my postings to every counselor, and I include the number of members the page has. So now there is close to 7,500. So that's a lot of members, and I think that's made them look more carefully at my messages to them. However, people have to fill their email box in. They have to come down to council, and they have to speak up, and that's when change will happen, because I think they would like to do things. I think they would like to stop this. It's grotesque what's happening, but they have to know that the public supports the kind of changes that they're going to need to make to stop this, and that involves people not just complaining. And you know, I understand that people are tired. I'm very tired too, and I understand that they feel that they're not listened to. You know, they might send emails, and they never get an answer.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that they didn't hear you.
Yeah.
If you don't get an answer, it doesn't necessarily mean they didn't listen. And if enough people speak out, they will listen. They have no choice.
Indeed.
They want to. I believe now that they want to fix this problem.
So this book, Carolyn, and all your advocacy has been a great service to this town. Congratulations on this book. I understand it's a bestseller already, number one on the list.
Thank you. But let me say, too, it was a group effort.
Indeed.
There's a group of writers and other photographers involved as well. And also the Facebook page, it's only effective because so many people have got on board and participated in the discussions that go on there. So the credit goes to everybody who is speaking out and everybody who loves this city.
Thanks for this, Carolyn. I've enjoyed the chat.
Yes, thanks, Joe.
And continued good luck and best of the season. Happy Christmas and all that.
You too. Bye-bye.
The book is called Vancouver Vanishes, Narratives of Demolition and Revival. It's published by Anvil Press. Its author, Carolyn Addison, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.